Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts here on the channel, and today we are talking to Jonathan Coley about his book, Gay on God's Campus, Mobilizing for LGBT Equality at Christian Colleges and Universities. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Thank you for being here. So can you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, my name is Jonathan Coley. As you stated, I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Monmouth College currently. We'll be joining the Department of Sociology at Oklahoma State University this summer. And this book really stemmed out, was inspired by my own experiences working for LGBT equality at a Christian university. I worked as an undergraduate to try to establish a gay-straight alliance at a conservative Baptist university in Birmingham, Alabama, Samford University. And since then, when I got to graduate school, I've been really interested and inspired by a lot of LGBT student mobilization at Christian colleges and universities. And so I decided to study it for my master's and dissertation, which then spawned this book project.
In the introduction, you sort of introduce us to three people who become archetypes of the things that you talk about throughout the book. So we've got Neil, we've got Ashley, and we've got Julie. So I'm hoping you can set the stage for us here by introducing them and sort of how they kind of set the stage for your book.
In the book, I study four Christian colleges and universities: Catholic University of America, a very conservative Catholic university in Washington, D.C., Goshen College, a social justice-minded Mennonite college in northern Indiana, Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, and Loyola University Chicago, a fairly liberal campus in Chicago, Illinois. So one of my very first sites where I began conducting interviews was at the Catholic University of America, where I begin my book. I met these three very, very different individuals very early on in my research who were nevertheless involved in LGBT activism at a Christian university. There was Neil, who is actually a self-proclaimed anarchist, a gay man, but someone for whom his political identity is really central. He was actually an atheist who came to Catholic University not because of his school's Catholic identity, but because he was really wanting to be in Washington, D.C. And he joined this LGBT group because he was the victim of a hate crime at Catholic University. Someone slashed the tires of his car, spray painted his car, was really astonished by his treatment by school officials. On the other hand, I met a student whom I called Ashley, who was a graduate student studying religion at Catholic University, who told me, and this was her words, that she used to be a fundamentalist Christian who very much believed that her own same-sex attractions were sinful, She used to think that she would be sent to hell if she had pursued a same-sex relationship and had some suicidal thoughts. So she was very much there at Catholic University because of her religious identity. Her religious identity was very much central for her. And she decided to become an LGBT activist, mostly because she had gone through this really intense process of re-socialization, working through her own religious beliefs about LGBT rights. And she became involved in the group to try to spread the word about how one could be gay and Christian. And then finally, I encountered this individual, Julie, who wasn't really much of an activist, didn't really have much of a political background, wasn't particularly religious. Instead, she became involved in an LGBT group, mostly because she herself was a lesbian, and she really wanted to meet others like her and to build spaces of LGBT inclusion on her campuses. So for me, these three individuals really represent a diverse mix of LGBT activists and are representative of three very different types of LGBT activists who nevertheless are all very engaged in trying to pursue social change.
Great, thank you. So one of the things that you do in the introduction, which I think is really helpful for the readers, is that you sort of introduce us to some, you know, key terms that are used in like the social movement literature and in studies that study activism. And so I was hoping you could sort of go through some of what those are and how they related to your project. So for instance, you know, you actually give them a term of politicized participants and micro-mobilization. So just sort of like helping us understand kind of the context that you're studying.
Yeah, absolutely. So I draw on a body of literature on social movement participation, sometimes called micro-mobilization, which is an individual's recruitment into an activist group. And when I went on to the campuses of Christian universities like Catholic University, I very much expected to meet people like Neil, whom I call a politicized participant. He had been socialized and really taught political and religious teachings that very much aligned with his involvement in an LGBT group. He had previously participated in an LGBT group. He had something called attitudinal affinity with this LGBT group, which simply meant his beliefs, his values, again, aligned with the LGBT movement. I use this term called microstructural availability, which is a fancy way of saying he was surrounded by friends. He was surrounded by classmates, people in his personal network who all very much reaffirmed his identity as an LGBT activist. So the social movement participation literature had really emphasized those characteristics as being central to explaining social movement participation. And much of what I was doing by introducing the stories of Ashley, whom I call a religious participant, someone participating in an LGBT group very much because of her religious identity. And by introducing people like Julie, who was an LGBT participant, someone who became involved in an LGBT group because of her own sexual identity, was to try to show how some of these characteristics presumed to be central to social movement participation actually aren't always relevant for different kinds of activists.
So something that you point out in the introduction that I think, you know, maybe some people have asked you previously are, why would you study LGBT students who are attending college, Christian colleges in the first place? So I was hoping you could talk more about that and in terms of like how that led to your method. So how you chose, like you talk in the book, you chose different locations and denominations. And so sort of how your methods came about from that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do get the question a lot of why study LGBT students at Christian colleges and universities. No one necessarily makes students go to these schools. And Christian colleges and universities are, at least currently, thought to be protected by the First Amendment and their occasional desire to discriminate against LGBT students. So I start out noting some of the diverse reasons that LGBT students attend Christian colleges and universities in the first place. Some LGBT students are both LGBT and religious. They're deeply religious oftentimes, and they seek out a place where they can grow in their faith at the same time as they pursue a college degree. Other students attend a Christian college or university for reasons that would apply to straight and LGBT people alike. They have gone to a school in a really exciting city like Chicago or Washington, D.C. They've gone to a school that is really great academically. They've gone to a school because they received a lot of financial aid there. They've gone to the school because their parents encouraged them to do so. And this is the part that might surprise some readers, but some Christian colleges and universities are actually quite inclusive of LGBT students, or at least they advertise themselves as such. So I found that 55% of Christian colleges and universities in the U.S. currently have inclusive non-discrimination policies. They do not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. 45% of Christian-affiliated colleges and universities have LGBT student groups. And so they advertise themselves as quite inclusive when LGBT students are applying. Now, when LGBT students get there, oftentimes they encounter a campus culture that is not so welcoming, not so inclusive in practice, and that inspires their subsequent activism. For example, at Loyola University Chicago, a campus that seems very LGBT inclusive on the surface, does not allow same-sex couples to get married on campus. Or Goshen College, it calls itself a social justice college. That's its identity. It very much tells prospective students that it is inclusive because it does have an LGBT support group. Yet until 2015, it was firing any faculty or staff members who came out as lesbian, gay, or bisexual. And so LGBT students are mobilizing at many schools like this that say they're inclusive, but may not be highly inclusive in practice. And even those conservative schools that don't yet have LGBT groups, even for those schools, it's not beyond the bounds of expectations that they'll be LGBT inclusive in 5 or 10 years. Because, well, Catholic University, one of the sites I studied, actually did have an inclusive non-discrimination policy and an LGBT group back in the 80s and 90s. And Belmont University, a formerly Southern Baptist University, prohibited homosexual behavior, homosexual acts in its student handbook up until 2009, yet just a couple years later decided to change its tune. There's hope for a lot of LGBT students, even at more conservative Christian colleges and universities.
So this sort of leads into chapter one, where you give us sort of the history of activist groups that begin emerging on Christian campuses. And you talk about how it sort of starts in the 80s, but it definitely takes flight in the 90s and 2000s. So I was hoping you could sort of give us that a brief history and how you saw that tying in to your study.
In many ways, the story of LGBT equality at Christian colleges and universities is fairly similar to the story of LGBT equality at the nation at large. You began to see more and more LGBT people coming out, especially in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, and 80s, inspired by other minority group movements. public policy and public opinion slowly began to change. You saw more and more local cities as well as states adopt inclusive non-discrimination policies, for example. And this just fed into a growing movement for LGBT equality, culminating of perhaps in recent years by the Supreme Court's approval of same-sex marriage. And what's really important for my story of LGBT equality at Christian colleges and universities is that this this growing drumbeat for LGBT equality really inspired several Christian denominations with which Christian colleges are affiliated, such as the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Church of Christ, the Disciples of Christ, among others, to embrace LGBT equality, which affirmed many students' efforts to promote LGBT equality on their campuses. And it's especially with the growing support of the religious community for LGBT people that you began to see so much mobilization for LGBT equality at Christian colleges and universities, especially by the, especially beginning in the 1990s, but especially by the 2000s and 2010s.
Great, thank you. And so this sort of ties into some of the discussion in the chapter about, you know, the political environment, but also the idea, you bring up resource mobilization theory in terms of, you know, you do find that wealthier schools are more inclusive, but you come away saying that, like, you know, denominations are really sort of what's important here. So I was hoping that you could talk about that, but also this database that you were using to investigate that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did build a database of the presence of LGBT support groups and the presence of inclusive non-discrimination policies for the 682 Christian colleges and universities I identified. And I found that a school's affiliated denomination or religious tradition really is the most important factor for a school's support of their LGBT students, although not always in the way people would expect. Because a Christian denomination's teachings on same-sex relationships does not necessarily lead all of those affiliated schools to exclude or include LGBT students. For example, the United Methodist Church currently says that same-sex relationships are sinful. The Roman Catholic Church says that homosexual acts, as it were, are acts of what they call grave depravity. Yet, Christian colleges and universities affiliated with the United Methodist Church and the Roman Catholic Church are actually quite inclusive of LGBT students. So what I found is Christian denominations' emphasis on social justice, its communal orientation, as I call it, as opposed to an emphasis on personal piety, kind of an obsession with an individual's personal purity that predicts LGBT inclusion. So because the Roman Catholic Church, the United Methodist Church, along with some of the denominations I mentioned earlier, do have a history of support for social justice. They have communal orientations. They generally do support their LGBT students. And it's the more individualistic denominations that emphasize personal piety, like the Southern Baptist Convention, like the Nazarenes or Assemblies of God. It's their schools that generally exclude and often discriminate their LGBT students.
So in chapter two, you move into this idea of the groups that you found. And something that I thought was really interesting in reflecting back on previous literature is that, you know, the activist literature tends to show that people are often socialized into this. They report prior participation, but you actually found that that type of student was rather a minority, only 31% of your sample. And so I was hoping you could talk kind of a about finding that out, and like for you as the researcher, how you felt about that when you kind of came to this conclusion?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised that, as you've mentioned, fewer than one third of my respondents really exhibited most of the traits that prior researchers had said were so important for participation in an activist group. In another of my earliest interviews, I remember meeting this student at Belmont University who I call Beth. And I used to go through this spiel in my interviews that said, you know, my name is Jonathan Coley. I'm interested in this project, partly because I've been involved. I've personally been involved in some LGBT protest, including at schools like Belmont University. And I was really surprised that this student, Beth, who is actually a leader in her group at Belmont University, went on to tell me that she actually believed herself that same-sex relationships were sinful. And despite being attracted to other women, she will not go on to marry another woman. She doesn't believe that's God's will for her life. Although she was really motivated to get involved with an LGBT group because she did want to dispel certain stereotypes about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Because she did believe that LGBT people deserve rights, even if she has some qualms with the theology. Like I mentioned, politicized participants do very much embody characteristics like prior socialization and prior activist group participation and an attitudinal agreement with the LGBT movement. But students like Beth, these people really motivated by religious identities, they actually never reported prior activist group participation. They never reported socialization into pro-LGBT values. And only occasionally did they actually agree with the LGBT movement when they joined. And the largest group of all, the people participating simply because they were LGBT, that comprised the majority of participants, they too rarely had very highly politicized backgrounds. And although they all agreed with the LGBT movement when they joined, they really do not exhibit the prototypical activist in many other ways. So meeting people like Beth really early on really sensitized me to the diversity of my respondents, really got me to rethink making any assumptions about the people I'd be meeting, and led to the results I described in my chapter.
Something that really stuck out to me is this idea of identities and how sometimes it developed before they got involved, sometimes it develops after they get involved. And so I was hoping you could just talk more about identities.
Yeah, so I really did find that identity was kind of the key variable differentiating a lot of people whom I talked to. So I met people with highly politicized identity for whom politics social justice was a motivating factor for their activism. Other people who were highly religious, that was the big factor. And people who were LGBT first and foremost, and that's why they participated. So I met a lot of people who were straight, or at least thought they might be straight when they first joined. And so some of my religious participants and politicized participants, they joined because they were straight, or sometimes they would go on to come out as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. But that's really only after participating in the group and after going through a lot of the process of trying to unpack their identity that a lot of college students go through. And so it certainly wasn't the case that all the students I talked to were LGBT.
So then in chapter three, you move into this typology. And as someone who's not as familiar with like social activism research, I found that table 3.1 on page 71 was actually really helpful because you sort of tie together the participants' identities, these three identities, and then the group ethos. So I was hoping that you could go through each one and kind of explain those to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, when I first started this research, I had already been well sensitized to insights from the social movement literature. And the social movements literature defines a social movement as a group of people working with some degree of organization, continuity, that deploy, and this is the key, extra institutional protest tactics in pursuit of social change or occasionally in defense of the social order. Extra institutional protest tactics, for example, sit-ins, protests, rallies, they are methods of facilitating social change that do not require the group to work within the existing institutions that have been set up by society. The existing ways our society has set up to allow people to express their voice, such as the voting booth. And so I certainly did encounter some groups working to promote LGBT equality that took this form. They're what I call the direct action groups. People for whom their politics were really central, the politicized participants, were drawn to direct action groups that do seek structural or policy changes through more confrontational, extra-institutional forms of collective action. But I also encountered two other types of activist groups that do pursue social change, but they do so through different means. So educational groups to whom religious participants were particularly drawn work to establish a shared set of values and to raise consciousness about those values in their community through more institutional means or through more conciliatory means. So outside of group meetings, they often hold lectures. They bring in academic speakers. They often have movie showings, or they just have ways of trying to pursue social change that involve getting the word out about LGBT issues, but not necessarily working outside the existing ways their colleges and universities have set up to allow for education. And then I met people who were active in what I call solidarity groups. So people for whom sexual or gender identity was really central were drawn to solidarity groups. And they exist mostly to facilitate members' personal development, to assist members, for example, in their coming out processes, and to connect LGBT people with each other within a very safe space on campus. These direct action groups, educational groups, and solidarity groups comprise a field of LGBT activist groups on these Christian colleges and university campuses.
Also in chapter three, it was kind of interesting because you also sort of did some analysis, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you sort of did some analysis of your interviews where then you wanted to go ahead and check using, you know, regular sort of modeling, quantitative modeling, I mean, in terms of whether you find that these identities match up with the groups. And you do find that, you know, you find that the activist identity is really tied to direct action groups and that the religious identity is tied to education. But I thought something that was really interesting, and I'm referring to table 3.2 on page 88, is this idea that like the LGBT identity, they do mostly talk about solidarity, but they also talk about direct action and educational. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. And did you feel like that when you were interviewing these students who you felt fit into that typology, that like those sort of groups, had sort of more diverse goals, I guess, or like how do you see that playing out in your data?
Yeah, absolutely. So direct action groups, educational groups, and solidarity groups alike in my sample do all have this overarching similarity, and that's that they exist to promote LGBT inclusion and to promote LGBT equality. So even though I do find that LGBT participants are particularly drawn to solidarity groups, that overarching LGBT organizational identity does prove to be a draw for LGBT students who aren't necessarily the kinds of people who always get involved in promoting direct action, or who aren't most interested in talking out issues related to the intersection of religious identity and sexuality, which is what educational groups often do. The LGBT organizational identity that's common to all three types of groups does mean that people with really salient LGBT identities will nevertheless get involved in types of groups that they, at least I might not expected, might not expect them to be involved in otherwise. But I do show that people with really salient activist identities, for example, really do focus on involvement in the direct action group more than any other. A lot of these activists, people with pre-existing activist identities, were heterosexual, for example. So the solidarity group that really existed by and for LGBT people wasn't really a great fit for them. Or people for whom religion was extremely salient, which again often included straight people, the solidarity group wouldn't be much of a draw for them. And kind of surprisingly for me, the religious identity was really at odds with participation in direct action groups. A lot of people who had a really salient religious identity were pretty conservative Christians, and they just kind of bristled. They really did not like the idea of getting involved in a very public protest. So they really shied away from heavy, heavy involvement in those kinds of groups. But LGBT people, they were pretty involved in all three types of groups.
And I just wanted to read this quote you have about, it was basically a donor for Belmont said, you know, Belmont has to decide whether they want to be a nationally recognized university, particularly with their school of music business, or if they want to be a church. And so I sort of thought that that was like the perfect quote for this chapter. So I was hoping you could talk more about how you saw this creating change happening from your interviews.
Yeah, absolutely. So that person you quote is actually, there's actually a really interesting story behind that. So I conducted much of my research from Nashville, Tennessee. I went to Vanderbilt University to complete my PhD, and the school Belmont University was right across the street, and it had been affiliated with the Tennessee Baptist Convention up until 2009. It had a ban on homosexual acts and homosexual behavior up to that time, and even a little after it. And students at Belmont University began mobilizing in favor of an inclusive non-discrimination policy and in favor of an official LGBT group when a lesbian soccer coach at the school was suddenly fired, or at least departed from the school under very confusing terms. And the students at that school really, really emphasized the idea that being a Christian means loving everyone. And they really tried to reiterate an alignment with Christianity and support for LGBT rights. And that caught the attention of this donor named Mike Kerb, who is actually a former Republican lieutenant governor of California. He was a fairly conservative person, and he is the man behind Kerb Records, a record, a label record studio in Nashville, Tennessee. His own name was on some of the buildings at Belmont University. He provided a lot of funding for Belmont University. And so that quote, that really, really powerful quote, saying that Belmont needs to decide whether it wants to be a church or a university. And another quote he gave that said pretty much along the lines of, "I swear, if this is not changed soon, I will continue speaking out about this for the rest of my life." That kind of message from a really powerful donor that reiterated the Christian messaging of a lot of these student protesters as well. The really caught the attention of Belmont's administration and convinced them to change in their policies.
Yeah, so I just thought it was sort of interesting, you know, how it's not just the activist group too, but it's like sort of outside influences on these changes as well. That's kind of interesting.
That's right. Yeah, I really think money talks. And it's a lot of these schools' alignment with rather conservative denominations that hold money over their heads. And their receipt of funds from donors who want particular policies that can prevent them from changing, but in the case of Belmont, actually allowed them to finally go ahead and approve an LGBT group and adopt an inclusive non-discrimination policy.
So then in chapter 5, you move into talking about how being involved in these activist groups actually impacts these students' future. You kind of talk about the political impact, the career impact, but also like the family and relational impact. So I was hoping you could sort of tell us a little bit about how you saw that happening in your interviews.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm engaging with a body of literature on the biographical consequences of social movements that shows that even when activist groups, even when social movements do not always achieve the goals they really wanted to bring about, they still at least have really, really powerful, enduring impacts on the lives of their participants. And so I'm engaging with some prior insights from that literature, but also showing how the unique types of activist groups that I identified in my study can induce different types of impacts in the lives of their participants. So direct action groups, those groups most embodying, most resembling the social movement groups that scholars traditionally study, are most likely to graduate participants who go on to pursue social movement involvement or political participation. For example, Neil, the anarchist that we talked about at the beginning of the interview, went on to be really fully engaged, fully employed in direct action organizing in Washington, D.C. But I also talk to people from educational groups that are, again, about establishing a shared set of values, raising consciousness about those values through more conciliatory institutional means, who began to see themselves as activists as well. But they wanted to pursue social change through pursuit of humanistic careers after graduation, jobs with church reform organizations, for example, or careers in social services that cater to the LGBT community. A lot of my respondents said that getting up in front of a large audience, sitting down one-on-one with the leaders of their schools, really helped them gain a skill set that was really highly transferable to a lot of those careers. And then finally, solidarity groups that were really trying to build a safe space on campus and to facilitate members' personal growth. Most often graduated participants who sought to bring about social change on a very individual level basis. And interestingly, a lot of them reported that they revised their family plans as a result of participating in their LGBT group. They said they now plan to enter into more equitable marital partnerships. they plan to raise really tolerant, really accepting children who would be much more tolerant and accepting than their parents had been oftentimes. And finally, I'll mention there was one kind of impact that was just extremely common across all of the Christian colleges and universities, across all the participants I talked to. And that was really immediate impacts in their existing relationships with family members and friends. A lot of them simply felt emboldened to talk about LGBT issues in really frank and direct ways with family members, with friends, and again, in really frank and direct ways that they wouldn't have prior to participation in an LGBT group. So overall, this participation in LGBT groups was just deeply empowering, but in some distinct and unique ways for different participants.
Great. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, sort of how that plays out for each of them, for each group. So then in the conclusion, what I really liked actually about your conclusion is that you sort of give us key takeaways, which I hope you'll let us know today, but also you point out that you have, your study came about with, you know, both theoretical and sort of bigger picture, takeaways. So I was hoping that you could sort of give us, those in terms of, you know, the theoretical ones, but also sort of these bigger picture ideas.
Absolutely. So we've talked about a lot of the theoretical implications, over the course of the interview. Two of the biggest being that number one, the idea that there is just a single prototypical activist who we can find in pretty much any activist group in the country, that prototypical activist is largely a myth, and in fact might be the minority in a lot of movements. A lot of people involved in LGBT activism don't have a lot of the basic previously assumed prerequisites for activist group participation, including attitudinal affinity with their LGBT group. Including being embedded in personal networks full of people who support their commitment to LGBT equality. So that's one theoretical takeaway. There are very distinct kinds of activists all mobilizing to pursue social change. The second major theoretical takeaway would be that we need to adopt a more inclusive understanding of activism itself. There are multiple ways to engage in social change, which is how I define activism, the pursuit of social change. You can do it through the confines of a social movement group. But as I think scholars of women's movement and other LGBT movements have become increasingly sensitive to, you can also do it through education. You can do it through consciousness raising. You can do it through everyday activism, through everyday conversation with one's peers, with one's family and friends. I note those as some major theoretical takeaways for scholars, but I also emphasize these broader implications, I think, for all kinds of readers. LGBT students attending Christian colleges and universities are a very disadvantaged minority in many ways. They face bullying, they face harassment from their friends. Many of them have been rejected or go on to be rejected by the people who you'd expect that would love them the most, their family members, their brothers and sisters. You would expect this group to be victims, to be resigned to their fate as victims. And it certainly is true that rates of suicide and rates of mental illness are quite high among the LGBT student population, especially at these colleges and universities. But the major takeaway, I think, for the broader public is that these LGBT groups on Christian colleges and universities move students from merely being these victims of some pretty oppressive campus cultures to being change agents, and they foster resiliency. They foster agency in a lot of students. And even when they do not convince administrators to change their policies, even when they haven't caught the attention of powerful donors or denominational officials, and convince them to change the policies at their schools. They go on to live really fully, really meaningful lives, really full lives. And perhaps they'll go on to be change agents and other Christian venues in their Christian denominations at large, and certainly in society at large. So that was a big takeaway for me. These LGBT groups have the potential, and certainly have for many accomplished moving students, from merely being oppressed to really being change agents who go on to do some really great, powerful things in life.
So today we've been talking to Jonathan Coley about his book, Gay on God's Campus, Mobilizing the LGBT Equality at LGBT Equality at Christian Colleges and Universities. So thank you for being here today, Jonathan.
Thank you so much for having me. I really love this podcast series, and you've been a great host.
Great, thank you. So what are you working on now?
So I am finishing up some small projects related to LGBT issues at Christian colleges and universities. I'm working on a paper, for example, that identifies the presence of student handbook bans on homosexual acts and homosexual behavior at Christian colleges and universities in their student handbooks. I'm also continuing a major research project drawing on oral history interviews with people who participated in the Nashville Civil Rights Movement of the early 1960s. I've been really lucky to work alongside the sociologists Larry Isaac and Dan Kornfield, the historian Dennis Dickerson, and a civil rights activist, James Lawson, to try to understand the lives of civil rights activists, to really hear their stories over 50 years, actually, after they participated in Nashville civil rights activism. And I certainly am going to continue to pursue additional research on social movement participation, and especially LGBT mobilization in religious context. And I'm in the very early planning stages of a project on LGBT mobilization within Christian denominations more generally.
Those sound really interesting. So thanks again for being here with us today.
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure to talk.
Thank you. Take care.